Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Thanks for joining us at the University of California Santa Barbara Technology Management Program. We're delighted to have you here this evening. I wanted to make you aware the viewership when we started this process 4 or 5 years ago was around 12 million broadcast footprint. It is currently 22 million broadcast footprint. That's on the Dish Network with about 460 channels. So at any given time, we might have half or 1%, 2% of that. But it is significant, so we thank you for your participation. And we'll have mics on either side for question and answer at the end of the presentation. Thank you very much.
Hi, and welcome to tonight's lecture. Today we face a market demand to gain influence and attract attention, where it's not only what you say, but how you say it that matters. Saying something is nominal, but saying something with quality, influence, and flawless execution can prevent company crisis. It can push new innovations forward and create a company culture and presence capable of facing high stakes and defining issues. Davies Public Affairs works to address and prevent the most controversial and challenging issues that real estate, healthcare, natural energy, and resource markets face today. John Davies has grown Davies Public Affairs into a renowned agency. Awarded Agency of the Year by the Holmes Report in 2006 and the Best Consultancy to Work For in 2008. Let's give him a round of applause.
Good afternoon. Last year, I was flying a lot, like I always do, and I had this revelation that I thought I had Alzheimer's. I really thought it was starting to come on, and I'm really worried about it. And so I went to my doctor, and I said, I think I have a problem. I'm leaving stuff on airplanes. I literally walked off and left my bag at the foot of the plane. I leave glasses, iPods, stuff on planes. I'm constantly turning around and going backwards all the time, trying to find out where I left things. And so he did what he does with a lot of things, and he laughed at me. You know, you're not going to have a heart attack. No, you don't have Alzheimer's. So how are you living your life? What are you doing? What's changed? Well, what has changed is I got an iPhone, but I kept my BlackBerry. And so I was getting the iPhone working on different things. I'm on a phone call, the plane lands, I get on a phone call, and then I'm using my BlackBerry to email. And then while I'm on a call and it's boring and I'm waiting for a message to go through, I get on the iPhone and I get on the web and I start surfing some of the news sites for our clients to see what's going on. And then I get up and I get off the plane and I leave books, Kindles. And you know, if it's really good, you never get it back. Or if it's really important. So I had this flash of the obvious. And what it was is related to a story I used to tell at the end of a program that I would give. So today I'm going to start with that in a couple minutes, because that little throwaway story at the end, to me, is what the world of communications is about today. And it was that little experience that got me there. So about 20 years ago, I decided that I wasn't in public relations or public affairs or marketing, and we used to do political campaigns, that I was really in persuasion, that I needed to figure out how the world worked. How does the world work? How does the science of compliance, which I think is the greatest science you could be in, which is a science of getting someone to do what you want them to do, how does that work? And how do I get to play with that? And how do I get others to do what I want to do? So I've spent the last two decades of my life working on that, trying to figure out how that works. And that's led me to do a lot of reading, do a lot of study. And most of what I've learned has come out of academics. And the business world doesn't see what comes out of academics for about 20 years. And I think all those of you that are professors here know that. It takes a couple decades for the business community to understand what it is. So communications is sort of this thing that we all talk about, but we really don't understand. And now we have all these technologies that teach us how to communicate and help us communicate, but we really don't understand communications. I contend that communications is probably the most talked about and least understood element of human behavior. And by the way, that's what separates us, right? That's what separates us from the animal kingdom. Our ability to communicate verbally, non-verbally, by computer, by touch, that's what makes us different, besides having an opposable thumb. But my two Vizslas think they have opposable thumbs. They have opposable paws. But that's what makes us different. That's how we're able to communicate with the world, how we're able to get things done and change things. But at the end of the day, do we really know how to communicate? And I think we're getting worse. Matter of fact, I think we're getting drastically worse in our ability to communicate. I think as a society that we've gone downhill so badly that many of our ills that our society faces today, they're totally based on our lack of ability to communicate, and that leading to a lack of a community, just period, having a community. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. We have 45 minutes, so I'm going to touch just a few things just to make you think a little bit. But mostly today, we're all starved for attention. We're starved for attention. We're trying to get attention, aren't we? We're trying to get someone's attention. Because if I get your attention for just a few minutes, I mean, you guys think about this. You're looking for a job. You're looking to sell an idea. If you have the right message in front of the right person for 10 minutes, it's worth more than 10 years worth of anything else. So we're all trying to get someone's attention. And everyone's trying to get our attention. So for the first time, it's all about attention and how we get people's attention. Excuse me, can I have your attention yesterday?
Maybe if I was talking to you yesterday.
We're a little wormhole? No, I can't have your attention. Attention is perishable. We lose it. So it's a commodity. Attention is a commodity today. It's a currency. It's how our world works. If you have people's attention, you want more attention. If you don't have any, you want it. You can buy it. You can sell it. And so that's what we're going to look at, is looking at, you know, how to get people's attention, how to work on getting attention, and how we get to play with that a little bit. So the funny thing about attention is that it works on both sides of the equation, right? You know, that I want your attention, and I want to keep your attention away. So on wanting attention and trying to get information out, you know, we can't just have Blackberries and iPhones with email now. I mean, give me a break. I mean, email, sending a picture over email from your iPhone, that's like, we had to get MMS, right? Which took out your web server. I mean, it's, you know, my son's like, Dad, why do I have an email account? I text everything. So everything's so fast, we got to text it. We couldn't possibly wait for an email and then respond and do it. We have to text right back. But then on the other side, we have spam filters, don't we? I look in my junk mail and I'm shocked at how much stuff is in my junk mail every day. And we also screen phone calls, right? The phone rings, and we look and we say, what's your name?
Paul.
I don't think so. Not right now. Not Paul. That never happened in a society. The phone rang, and you picked up the phone and said, hello? Oh. And if you didn't want to talk to someone, you didn't answer the phone, period. But now we get to screen. So we're working on both sides of that on attention, how we deal with people, how we get attention, how we communicate with them. So it's in short supply. So one of the things I want to share is what I ended with, the old stories. And any of you been here in the summer, students-wise, you're here in the summer in Santa Barbara, we have old Spanish days, fiesta. I call it old white middle class days because all the guys that put it on are white middle class guys, and it's not really old Spanish days. But anyway, the one place that still happens is this little place called Our Lady of Guadalupe Church, Lower East Side, incredible food. I was there maybe 10, 15 years ago, just having an eating feast. And this little girl comes up and says, hey, mister, she's all dressed in her Spanish dance. Would you buy a raffle ticket, 3 for $1? I said, sure. And I had this amazing sopa. Did I say that right? Sopia? Sopa. And it was like goat meat with peas. I mean, are you kidding me? It was so good. So I balanced it on this foamy top, amber, bubbly liquid. What'd you say? Beer, yes. Yeah, I had that. That's one time I had it. And I balanced it, and I reached in, and I got a dollar bill, and I gave her a dollar bill, and she gave me the tickets, and I put it in my pocket. She went off. I had some carnitas. I went in line for the pozole, waited half hour, ate a huge thing of pozole, had another of those bubbly things. And I'm standing watching the Spanish dancers ready to explode because I had the corn thing, the barbecued corn where they put cheese, butter, mayonnaise, hot sauce. I don't even eat the corn. I just lick it and put it back and ask for a refill. So I'm about to die. And I reach in my pocket, and I pull out the little ticket because it's in there with all the dollar bills. And I look at that ticket, And that ticket had the message to me, which is how we need to communicate today. Because on the back of the ticket, it said, you must be present to win. And in our society today, none of us are present. We're not there. We spend most of our time doing other things, looking at two things at once. So I contend that if we can be present, we can change how people look at us and how things work. So let's look at, for a second, multitasking. How many of you think you can multitask? Raise your hand. Come on. Just because that came up before, I should have. Okay. How many women think women are better at multitasking? Okay, so here's the deal. I can't do this test with you, but I'm going to give it, and you need to go. So I'm sitting there thinking I have some type of memory problem. And what it is I'm trying to do two things at once, or three, and you can't do it. None of us can do it. Anything but a supercomputer. All these computers you guys have out right now, how many things can they do at once? One. Our brain can do one thing at once. So when we're trying to do two things, we lose it. So here's the test. So what I have you do is you write, multitasking is a worse lie. First you do M, then you do 1, then you do U, 2, and you carry on. You write that out. And I can't have you do it because it takes a few minutes to do it. So you do that, and then I have you do it differently. I have you write out multitasking is a worse lie straight out, and then I have you do the numbers. Okay, the result of this over the last 10, 12 months is the average time for the first part is about 50 seconds. What do you think the average time to do the two lists separately is? 20? 24 seconds. So what that says is when you try to do two things at once rather than do the two things separately, it takes twice as long. Pretty interesting, isn't it? We're all trying to do two things at once. We're trying to communicate with someone while we're texting someone else, and while we're texting the other person, we're writing what we're saying to the other person. When I talk to my wife when I'm doing email at the office, she goes, when you're done with the email, call me back. I mean, she knows in her heart because I go silent for 30 seconds, right? It's like, where'd you go? So number one thing is we got to be present to win, and we can't multitask. You know, we live in this society that says we can multitask. We can do all these things at once. We can do the reading, the phone, the email, but we can't. We do one thing. It's called quick switching. We switch between things quickly, and we leave a whole bunch of trail of clutter that we don't get done in between. We don't get anything done because we have to restart all the time. It just doesn't happen. So you guys trying to do stuff all at once, you just blow it up and you don't get anything done. And then we don't communicate with people. We don't get anything done, so it doesn't work. The other thing that I watch as we're going through society is I've wanted to get a video of that, but you can't do it. But the other thing is that don't raise your hand. How many people in here think that less than 10% of the people in this room smoke? Really? 20% of the people in the room smoke? How many don't understand the question? Everyone else. All right. I contend not a lot of people smoke, so we have this new habit. And the new habit, the new twitch we have, is we got to look at our phone every 2 seconds. Do you guys notice that? I mean, it's like a bad habit. People haven't gotten a text from anyone in 6 months. I mean, no one likes them. They're a pain in the neck, and they keep looking at their phone hoping someone texts them. I mean, it's the old cigarette in the hand. Go taking a break. But that's not the only thing that's happening. Is every one of you probably have Facebook account, MySpace account, Twitter, you're following people on Twitter. So if the BlackBerry and the iPhone and the texting is the cigarette of today, the social media is a junk food. And let me explain what I mean. It's a great tool. I mean, there's no better tool. And we're developing software where we get people to be activated by Facebook, where I can get you to do something and send out a letter to someone else to make them do something on Facebook. It's a great tool, but it's not your life. So here you are. We're doing the Facebook thing, and it's like coming home after not eating all day. And you come in the house, and you're starving. And your roommate left a big bag of potato chips on the counter. And you eat the entire bag of potato chips, knowing that you're going to go to dinner that night. That's already been paid for by someone. And you go to dinner, you can't eat. Because you're filled up with junk. So social media can fill your desire for relationships and connecting with people with junk. Because the relationships you have on Facebook back and forth with people is junk. It's a tool. It's not your life. It's not how you need to communicate. And I contend that virtual community is infinitely more virtual than community. It's all about being virtual. It's not about a community. And it's a great tool, and you got to use it. I use it. I love using it. But we got to be careful not to live on it and have that change how our society operates and how we play with one another. So if you're going to play with people, you need to make sure that you learn how to deal with them face-to-face. So I'm going to talk real quickly about some skills for speaking and communicating with people, because that's still the number one deal. That's why I fly 200,000 miles plus a year, is to go face-to-face and meet with people. And that's why in this economy that my company's still thriving, because as a CEO, I'm willing to cross the country every week, and meet with people face-to-face. Because talking to them on the phone or a webcast, that's great when you're in a detailed, you're doing the details, but to have a relationship, you have to see people face-to-face. It's just the way it is. So how do we present ourselves? So how many of you think great speakers just have an innate born ability? Raise your hand. How many of you think they develop it? How many aren't going to raise your hand no matter what I ask today? Mariel, I got you. Both speakers are creative. Some people have some great natural skills. Usually those who have great skills fall apart later because they get lazy. I was born with a really bad speech impediment. It's called verbal apraxia, and I couldn't feel my mouth, couldn't move my mouth right. And so until I was in third or fourth grade, I couldn't be understood, so I didn't talk, right? I mean, if you can't be understood, what do? You're quiet. And if I didn't talk, what did people think about me? That was what? Did someone say I was stupid? Yeah, people thought you're stupid. And so, you're communicating no matter what happens. So what makes a great speaker? First is you got to know what you're going to say, and you got to practice it, and you got to be rehearsed. Why do you think that people doing a big presentation, doing a big deal, don't get ready for it? Why do you think they don't do it, even though they have time? 2 weeks before, why do you think they don't do it? Why is that? Yeah. Part of it's that. The other part is they don't want to speak. It scares them. So starting to get prepared to speak makes you nervous. It doesn't it? You start getting ready to make a big speech, you start getting nervous about the speech. I don't want to get nervous, so forget it. I'd rather do something else. I'm going to go on Facebook. So my son does for homework. Instead of doing homework, starts getting hard, he goes on Facebook. He's taking a Facebook break. How about taking a homework break? So practice. Cal Ripken, great baseball player. How many games? 2,000, 3,000 games. Every game he walked out there, he hit 200, 250 baseballs. He was practiced. He was prepared. Michael Jordan finished a game, went in the locker room, and lifted weights. They're practiced and prepared. So that's a good one. Aware of nonverbals. We're going to talk about a few nonverbals. You're aware of your nonverbals. You're aware of other people's nonverbals. We'll talk about a little bit of them. We don't have a lot of time to do that. But there's some great research, mostly done in the 70s, on nonverbal. A lot of nonverbal research now being taken into poker because poker's so big. So it's a really cool thing to look at because the great poker players know how to deal with nonverbal. So aware of your nonverbals, aware of the audience's nonverbals. And then you have a persuasive message. So who is this guy? What's his name? C-3PO? What was his job? What was his job? He was a translator. He was a communicator. Did anyone listen to him? Why? He was missing one important element. He didn't have a heart. He didn't have passion for what he was doing. So you can have the great message, you can be aware of nonverbals, practice and prepared, but if you don't have passion, nothing happens. No one listens to you. So my deal is find out what you really have passion at, go into that field and stay in it, because that's where you really develop it. Someone stands up to give a speech and they don't have passion, we all know within a few minutes. We know it's not there. And you hear people have great passion and they speak and then everyone's eyes light up and none of the other things really matter. But persuasive message is probably pretty good, too, so you get people to do something. So one of the great speakers of all times, Martin Luther King, right? Incredible man, incredible speeches. Well, when he did the March on Washington, it was a big deal. People were going to watch that. That's in a time when no one was on TV. And so he's on TV, going to be a big march, and the civil rights movement was not all together, working together. And he was going to be the person that spoke, but they controlled the speech and they wrote a speech for him. And the beginning of this clip is a speech they wrote for him, and then he broke off from the speech. And watch his face and watch his motions and make sure we get the sound on this.
100 years later, the life of the Negro is still...
That's not me. That's not good. How about that? Oh, now we're back a little bit. Sorry about that. Playing my iTunes too much. So Martin Luther King's there. He's speaking. He sees the crowd. He reads the crowd. They're not there. All of America's watching. You know why most of white America was watching? They thought there was going to be a race riot. They wanted to see the violence. And so he has this incredible opportunity, and he takes advantage of it. So take a listen to him. Oh.
One 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later.
It's like golf applause.
The Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his...
He's about a minute into this, his speech.
Into his new second. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. And every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain. And the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. And all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope.
Pretty amazing difference, isn't it? And that happens with all of us. I spent a day in Washington. This group hired me to meet with a group of people every 20 minutes, one person to train them to do something. And in 20 minutes, I could change their speaking habits by having them talk to me about something they loved. Family, vacation, something they just loved to do, a hobby. And then have them talk about what they wanted to speak about in the speech, and they saw the difference, and it totally changed their behavior. Because they got passionate about what they loved, and it changed totally their nonverbal. You can't speak like Martin Luther King, neither can I. I can't speak like you when you're passionate, but all your friends know what that looks like. And so if you can be yourself in a passionate manner, it changes everyone's response to you. The whole room quiets down and they watch. Everything changes. Would have been good for one of our presidential candidates to learn some of this.
A rebuttal here?
Sure, but I just want to see if he buys that.
Let me just tell you what the facts are. The facts are, after my plan, the wealthiest of Americans pay more taxes of the percentage of the whole than they do today. Secondly, if you're a family of four making $50,000 in Massachusetts, you get a 50% tax cut. Let me give you one example. The Strunk family in Allentown, Pennsylvania. I campaigned with them the other day. They make $51,000 combined income. They pay about $3,800 in taxes, or $3,500 in taxes. Under my plan, they get $1,800 of tax relief.
I go on in this. And you'd see a lot. So Al Gore is running for president of the United States. We're at peace. The economy's great. He's a really smart man. He loses the election by his nonverbals. I listened to the speech driving from L.A. to Santa Barbara and then listened to the commentator saying Bush won the speech. I go, no, we didn't. Gore hammered him. Then I watched it. I said, oh. So studies after that speech, why people left Gore, went to undecided or to Bush or someone else. The number one open-ended statement women made, why they left him, tells the story better than anything, because he reminded me of my ex-wife. Because his behavior, do you want your ex-husband, I'm sorry, my ex-husband. It's a modern era, it could have been the ex-wife, but my ex-husband or my ex-boyfriend, that he was so out of control that they didn't want him to be president. And you think about that, behavior cost him the presidency. So any of you old enough that are here remember a guy named Joe Pine? Remember Joe Pine? Do you remember Joe Pine? Joe Pine was amazing, right? Joe Pine had a talk show in the 1960s, late 50s, early 60s, and he had people come on, wannabe actors and actresses, fringe political people. But there's no cable then, so it wasn't like anyone could be on TV. And he was angry and sort of grumpy and just tough on people. And some people said it was because he had lost his leg and there was in pain or he's mad, and who knows why. But he had Frank Zappa on. So Frank Zappa comes out, sits down next to Joe Pine. Joe Pine looks at him. So, Mr. Zappa, I guess your long hair makes you a girl. Zappa looks at Pine and says, I guess your wooden leg makes you a table. I contend that's how we make first impressions, that quick. So how long do you think we make first impressions now? How long does it take to make a first impression? Yell out. 10 seconds? How long? Half a second. A minute. Anyone else? 100 milliseconds of research now. 1/10 of 1 second. That means when you walk into a room, you stand up, you haven't said a word, you haven't done anything, it's all over. It's all over. Everyone's already decided everything they can think about you. They have a first impression. Think about how crazy that is. 1/10 of 1 second, they've decided your social class, your social heritage, your education level, your trustworthiness. We make these decisions all the time. So let's talk about how they do it. First is we start with 38% is from your tone and your voice. So talk about all these things. Number one thing to talk about is vocalizing your pauses. Anyone know what I mean by that? What's that? People use it for different reasons, but it's mostly you're vocalizing the white space in your speaking. That's a huge issue that you need to overcome. It makes you look like I was in third and fourth grade. What was it you said? Stupid? Yeah, it's bad. All the others we can talk about in more detail, but if you look at the voice, what an impact a voice has. Oh, I'm sorry, what happened to him? Everyone said it was because of his big ears, but it was his voice. We couldn't handle listening to him. And then we have Howard Dean, and I'm watching him in Iowa. He speaks, right? And he's screaming, and he's doing the scream, and everyone in the room is going, wow. But what happened is a guy sitting back in the front row behind him kept leaning forward, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. So I went searching, and I found what was happening. This place was going crazy. This is what's happening in the audience. This is a video from the audience from that night.
Not only are we going to New Hampshire, Tom Larkin, we're going to South Carolina and Oklahoma and Arizona and North Dakota and New Mexico. We're going to California and Texas and New York. We're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House.
He's having a ball. He's in a big audience with a big crowd, and it's, you know, all his young supporters from all over the country that went there, and they're screaming. They don't care that he didn't win. And that's who he's playing to, but the microphone on the stage was just to him. So all the media got was that. And it totally changed how people looked at his campaign. He was probably dead anyway, but that killed his campaign. We all know it was called The Scream. The Scream. I mean, that's sort of sad. So we look at 38% from tone of voice, 55% from nonverbal. So what are some nonverbals you think that matter?
Posture.
What's that?
Posture.
Posture is really good. Eye contact, top of the list. What's that? Body language. Smile. Smile. Let's look at smile a little bit. Remember him? Okay, he's going to talk, and then Bill Clinton's going to talk and say the same thing and see what the difference is.
But let's not put it there. Let's put it in terms of the average family. What has happened to you? We find that your wages have gone up 5 times as much in the Eisenhower administration as they did in the Truman administration. What about the prices you pay? We find that the prices you pay went up 5 times as much in the Truman administration as they did in the Eisenhower administration. What's the net result of this? This means that the average family income went up 15% in the Eisenhower years as against 2% in the Truman years. Now, this is not standing still.
When I ran for president, I said we'd cut the deficit in half in 4 years. We cut it by 60%. I said that our economic plan would produce 8 million jobs. We have 10.5 million new jobs. We're number one in autos again, record numbers of new small business.
So he's saying the same thing, how good things were and what it is. I mean, you see Nixon, it's like he's coming up to you saying, I'm sorry, is this your kitty? I was driving speed limit. Kitty came out, it's fluffy, right? It's not so fluffy, but I'm sorry, I ran over your cat. It's like, I mean, everyone says it's because he didn't shave. I'm sorry. It's like he's got the biggest frown in the world on his face, and he's trying to tell us how good things are. And then, you know, Clinton comes out, and besides the big bags on his eyes because he was partying the night before, you know, he looks like he's telling you great news, and you're going, yeah, everything's good. Thanks, Bill. We're going to party on. We're voting for you, dude. But, you know, Nixon looks like it's the end of the world. So to me, looking at the smile is one of the key nonverbals. But let's look at the only nonverbal John McCain had, which is smile. Everything else was a big problem for him.
I don't like to know.
In a word, no.
That's all he had, was a smile. When he walked, I have some great videos of him walking. You go, oh, you don't even know who it is. You don't know what he's doing. You're just going, that hurts. He walked like he hurt. He couldn't lift his arms. I mean, for a really amazing reason of what he did, he couldn't type. But it's still, they never should have had him walking. Then he had another nonverbal that drove me crazy in a primary. He had he'd stand in front of the room, they'd ask a question, and go, it's like, there's nothing like that to get a couple votes. So how many of you spend 93% of your time getting ready when you talk to someone or give a presentation, preparing your nonverbals and your tone of voice? None of us. How many of you spend 7% of your time thinking about what makes 93% of your first impression? Hardly any of us. So I could then suggest, probably encourage you to think about what your nonverbals are like, what happens when you're doing it. Franklin Roosevelt loved playing with people, and he was really into body language for obvious reasons. He was in a wheelchair, and he worried about how he looked and how he came across. So there's a great story of him having a party at the White House, and he's standing there, and they're holding him, and people are coming, and he's shaking hands. People coming in, they're shaking and shaking hands. Oh, Mr. President, it's so good to see you. And, you know, no one listens. They're just so shocked to be at the White House. And he goes, oh, good to see you. Thank you very much. I murdered my mother-in-law this morning. Very good to see you. I murdered my mother-in-law this morning. And no one listened because they're so focused on the nonverbal and meeting the president. No one listened to him. People next to him are just going, this is unbelievable. No one listens to what you say. They're just so amazed to meet you. But the key to this is, and why a lot of people fail in communications, is what they say. Do you know that guy?
Yeah.
Do you really? No. Oh. Someone knew him one time. He's a conductor, really. That they don't, what they say isn't what they believe. And it's inconsistent. And that's why so many politicians in America, especially in California in the last decade or so, you scratch your head and say, I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't think that person really believes what they're saying. And you do it subconsciously, because our whole nonverbal, we take things in nonverbally subconsciously, and we just don't buy it. But it's got to be in concert. They've all got to be same thing. They got to deal with it. So I'm going to talk about a couple of things I call body talk that relates to. And so if 55% comes from our body, we ought to study it a little bit. So the first one to me is if pupils teach. What do you think I mean by that? Anyone?
Dilation
of pupils. We're fascinated with eyes. People love looking at eyes. With babies, love looking at eyes. Babies make eye contact with you. You make eye contact back. A whole bunch of theories about why that works that we can't go into today, but we are into eye contact. We like looking at someone. By the way, can you see
Any nerve cells?
No.
Okay. How about here? Do you see any? I mean, that's the window to your brain, the window to your soul, right there, your eyes. And so we all know that. Subconsciously, we're watching other people's eyes. So we're looking at it. So there's four times as many neurons dedicated to visual and those two little things there than there are to touch, and 10 times as many to visual than hearing. And so as we go through life, we don't think about what we're doing with our eyes. So how you look at people, how you look at people after you talk to them, do you look down, do you look up, tells everyone something. And we're all reading that all the time. So why do you think pupils are so, the dilated pupils mean so much? What do you think it means?
You're expressing your feelings.
Yes, you are expressing your feelings, exactly. So dilated pupils, you respond to an external and an internal motivation. The external is the lights change, how your pupils dilate. Internally, it's based on emotions. When you see something you like, your pupils get bigger. Pretty interesting. So do you think we all know that when someone's pupils get bigger, they like us? We do. Subconsciously, we know. So when you look at photos, Eckert Hess did this. They did a study where it showed photos of people, their pupils, different sizes. Every time they showed the photos of the same people with their pupils larger, people like them more, so they're more attractive, and they're more trustworthy. So number one thing, you got to be able to make eye contact. So how many of you know people that just can't make eye contact? Yeah. I mean, it's really bad, isn't it? How many of you don't make great eye contact? Don't raise your hand. Yeah. No, it's hard. You know, it's an awkward thing, but you got to learn how to make better eye contact. You got to watch what your eye contact is and look for it. Now, you know, we may not like know one another really well, but if I find something I like about him or we have a conversation and I like him, my pupils will dilate because I like something about him. Well, we can't do that unless we meet face to face. We can't do that unless we have a relationship or community in some way. And not, my eyes don't, or my pupils don't dilate on Facebook or on texting or email. I have to do it face to face. I mean, you really have, and that's the only way, that's why face to face is so important, because you get it. You see, you're reading, you can't read another person if you're not face-to-face. And that's why we have to get face-to-face. So I was doing a crisis communications for a company, an oil company. They had a spill. They might have wanted to call me like before they had a spill, but they had a spill about 3 months before, and they wanted to make sure they never had such bad communications. So I was in Santa Maria, and I stayed at the Santa Maria Inn, across the street from the Santa Maria restaurant on Santa Maria Boulevard. And I had the Santa Marias all night. I was so sick. And I got up in the morning, and I was sick. So I got to deal with this. Somehow I got to deal with this. So I got up, took a shower, left, walking out in the hallway. If I had phone halo, I would have known if I left something in the room. But all of a sudden I get sick again. I go back. So I sat down, brushed my teeth, washed my face, and I hypnotized myself. I said, I'm good. I'm fine. Everything's fine. I faked my body into believing I was okay. So the interesting thing about your body is your body really doesn't know whether you're really going through something or you're just going through that thought process of that emotion. Because if I was to ask someone to come up here now and tell me and get into position in a time that you had really strong emotions, you were scared, you're mad, you're happy, your body would go into that exact state. I've done this with CEOs of Fortune 50 companies where I sit them down, within 5 minutes they have tears rolling down their cheeks. People that don't cry. Sitting there holding something. I asked them, the first child? Yeah. Could ask them to go someplace that was really emotional. Within 5 minutes, they can do what Tom Hanks does. And we all have that ability. So every day something takes us off our game. You gotta walk into a room, get off a plane, you guys have to go someplace, you have to speak. You got to be able to get yourself in the right frame of mind. So I hypnotized myself. I went into that meeting. I taught all day. Got hired, was a client for about a decade because of that one day. And as soon as they went out of the room and my staff and I started cleaning stuff up, I got sick again. It'd be pretty amazing how the power you can have over your body. I don't think you could like keep doing it for like a couple of years. I don't think you can pull out of H1N1 by talking to yourself. But you know, you have an amazing ability to fake your body into doing things. And you have to be able to do that when you go into a speech is really important, or a presentation, or when you're meeting someone, to be able to focus on them, focus on what you need to do. Now, this is an hour in itself, but I'm going to let it, so I'm going to leave it. The next one is what sort of hurt George Bush 41. He moved all over the place. He didn't have an economy of motion. People who are in charge or in power have an incredible ability to move, but move in a way that it's an economy of motion. And people watch them. They enter a room without haste, but they're just, they have a beat to them that you see. They don't move too much. I sat at a meeting with a group of powerful Fortune 50 guys, all in women, working on one deal. It's like one row around the table, one row next, one row back. I mean, it's like an amazing, intense group of people. And the guy leading the meeting never said a word to start the meeting or to move to the next person. He just went like this. And he summed up the meeting at the end, and we're done. He owned the room. So learn how to control how you move. Have an economy of motion, as this man does.
America, this is our moment. This is our time. Our time to turn the page on the policies of the past. Our time to bring new energy and new ideas.
We're close to 45 minutes. I'm going to go a couple more minutes. But I just want to say on Barack Obama that a truly gifted nonverbal speaker, more than just a verbal speaker. His nonverbals are what make him. I mean, truly amazing what he's able to do. So he's having the inaugural. And the night before or the day before, they're having a big event at the Lincoln Memorial. Now, when presidents hang out or politicians hang out with rock stars, it's always a huge geek factor for the politician, isn't it? You know, the rock stars are cool. Everything's great. Politician stands up and you go, oh, man, you shouldn't have done that. That's a bad contrast. You should have got someone else to stand up a little geekier, and then you come up. But Barack Obama stands up after these amazing musicians play, and he's cooler than them. His nonverbals were cooler than all of them. It's a pretty amazing deal. That's one of the great things he has going that he plays. It's not translating to presidential yet. That's his biggest challenge. The nonverbal hasn't become, I'm the president now, not the great candidate. And that's going to be the challenge that he has to overcome soon. He's great at rallying a crowd. He's great at having that poise, but he doesn't have the presidential deal yet, which he will. So I'm going to jump through a couple of these. So turf and room, we all have this thing about how much space we have around us. You guys need to figure that out, the close talker, the far talker, how much we get. It's really important how we play with turf. So if we're going to have a meeting and it's about negotiations, where do you want it, on your turf or their turf? Where? It all depends. Do you want to read their nonverbals or do you want to intimidate them? Because if you want to read their nonverbals, you go to their turf. If you want to intimidate them, you bring to your turf. If you want to play on an equal deal and try to get them to relax, you go to a neutral turf. I mean, I decide wherever I go is my turf. I go in, I say, this is my turf. I control this turf. Doesn't matter what happens. They can't kill me most of the time. So that's the only bad thing that can happen. I just may not get a deal, but it's my turf. So if you can do that, you always want to go to their turf because you can read them. So we have the talking heads. This guy gets paid a couple $1 million because he can nod his head and move it in the right way. But more importantly, we have the listening head. And this is important for us today because how do you listen? What do you do when you listen and you listen well? Are you listening well? Oh, you see, I was behind you. So what do you do when you're listening? How do you, non-verbally, what do you do? Cock your head. What else do you do? Eye contact. A lot of time, when people talk to you, they break eye contact when they're talking and they come back to you at the end of the conversation and the moment. But one of the things we do when we talk is we nod. And we have this really bad confusion with nods. There's different types of nods. You know, a little nod is like, uh-huh, 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 I'm listening to you.
I don't agree with you. Then it's like, okay, I agree with you. And then it's like, please be done because I have something to say. The most common nod in our society today. Okay, I got it. Let me go. So John Kerry had a nod problem.
My opponent looked at the same intelligence I looked at and declared in 2002 that Saddam Hussein was a grave threat. He also said in December of 2003 that anyone who doubts that the world is safer without Saddam Hussein does not have the judgment to be president.
Not good. Okay, watch this one. This one's even more. Now, remember the campaign. The issue against John Kerry was he says one thing and does another. I voted for, and then I voted against, and then I voted for, and I'm not sure. So watch them.
Sir, have we moved far enough along that we no longer need to use race and gender as a factor in school admissions and federal and state contracts and so on?
No, Bob. Regrettably, we have not moved far enough along.
No, Bob? He's going, no, Bob. It's like, no, Bob. He shouldn't have bobbed. And so that's really conflict. So on a nonverbal, I mean, he's sending a bad message that he's saying one thing and doing another. That hurt him. Those are the things that hurt these guys, which hurt us all the time. So this is my last one because I had to go to this one. Can't leave it. Okay, feet are the most honest part of your body. They are. I mean, think about kids. The kids sitting at dinner, you know, their feet start moving. You know, they want to go. Your eyes, sort of a window to your soul, but feet are the most honest part of your body. If you could play poker and see people's feet, you win every time. They have a bad hand, the feet immediately go to the door. When they're worried, their feet wrap around the leg of the chair. Feet are pretty amazing tools. Can you step up for a minute? I'm going to show you one deal that for personal conversations, you got your cigarettes with you? Okay, put them in your pocket. So if we're talking and we're having a conversation, and what's your name?
Jesse,
come on up. So we're talking, and Jesse comes up. What's your name?
Patrick.
Watch Patrick and I. So we open our feet for him. Now, step away. Don't open. Just you talking to me the way we're talking. Okay, now walk up to us. Jesse, walk. No, you stay here. You come up to us and don't turn your feet to him. Talk. We turn our bodies to him, talk to him. It's like, how you doing? But we don't turn our feet. You're not welcome to the thing. You feel it instantly, and you go away. It's like, hi, how are you? Good to see you.
I've been trying to meet you for a while.
Yeah, well, yeah. Thank you. But if you watch people, their feet tell you whether they want to have a relationship with you. You know, you watch jurors. When they point away, they see a witness, their feet point away from the witness. Your feet point to what you want and you don't want. It's the most honest part of your body. Yeah, pretty powerful. Think about, because no one watches it. And the thing is, the most honest start with the feet and that works up your body. So, you know, you're talking to someone, you really do want to meet Jesse, but you really want to finish talking to Patrick, but you don't want to lose Jesse. You have to force yourself to go, okay. You have to welcome him into the conversation because he will walk away. You go, how did that guy know I didn't want him to be here? I didn't, you know, we smiled at him. And he waved away. And he said, those guys aren't open to talk to him because you read that. So an ending, so I can take some questions. You know, I talked about you must be present to win. And on the back of that card, and, you know, there's two sides of that. One is you got to be present, mind, body, and spirit to be able to win. And then you got to go there and be part of it. You can't live your life, you know, hanging on your computer or hanging on our Blackberries. We just can't do it anymore. I mean, it was a neat little tool, but you got to go there, and then when you're there, you got to be present because you can't have a relationship with someone when you're doing two things at once. And the relationships is what makes community. And communities make an industry, make a business, and make a life for you. I mean, the statistics today of how many friends people have today versus 20 years ago, 30 years ago is pretty sad. It's not a good thing for our society. And it's something that you have an opportunity to do. Now you have the tools to keep in touch. Use those as tools, but don't use them as your only means of communications. And I thank you for being present for the entire time we're here today, and I'll take any questions you have. I think there's a question over there.
So you've probably dealt with a lot of different companies. What would you say is the number one problem you've seen overall?
Number one problem is a lack of a message. Where are you? Raise your hand. Wave at me. Go. That a lack of a message. That most people in business, even in controversial situations, don't know what their message is. And then, secondly, they don't want to get it out. They want to hide it. And they always, well, let's not get out. You know, when's it too late? Well, it's too late when it's too late and you can't do anything about it. So what are you going to say? And how are you going to control the agenda debate? So, you know, let's say the two of us are going to play a game for a lifetime income. You up for that? How about just the rest of the life? I get the rest of yours, you get the rest of mine. It's a good deal for me. And we're going to play a game of chance. And the game of chance, a game of skill, I mean. And it's, you play backgammon, and I'm going to play chess. Well, I'm really good at chess, you're really good at backgammon. What game do you want to play?
Well, I'm good at.
Right, what you're good at, backgammon. So in corporate America, and most businesses and most of our clients when we start, if I say, here, this is a backgammon, I flip it over and say chess, he flips it over and says backgammon, they'll play backgammon. You'll figure out your agenda, your winning agenda, and your message, and that's what you play, and never go to the other side's winning agenda or their message, and then you win. Barack Obama. He figured out what the winning agenda was for this campaign season, and he stayed there, and he never left it.
That was a wonderful, very insightful presentation, but I guess I have a personal question, because obviously starting from third grade and before, you weren't communicating, so what did you learn? I mean, what was the first thing that you did, and why did you get to where you are today?
Well, they sent me to a speech therapist, and they said that he has this problem, and it's like a huge surprise that my parents tortured me. They sent me to the grocery store when I had no help and go around the store trying to order something. It was quite an experience. But so if you haven't talked until you're 10 or 11 much, you've watched people a lot. So I think the opportunity I got in those first years of my life were to watch what people did and what other people did. And then I never stopped talking.
So for someone who's working remotely, what recommendations would you have? Do you think meeting over webcam is helpful to establishing that relationship so they understand that you're doing quality work? Or what kind of advice, how often do you think it's important to come into the office? What kind of advice do you have for that?
I think as much as you can get in the office and when you're there. The purpose of being in the office when you're there, when you're working remotely, is not to work. It's to have your relationships. I'm in my office in Santa Barbara maybe 2 days, the average week at best. I spend almost the whole time I'm there talking with people, moving around, dropping in people's offices, spending time keeping my relationship. So that when you're working remotely and then you go to the office, what most people do, they go find a cubicle, right? And they start working in the cubicle all day. That's not what you're there for. You're there to meet people and talk to people, have lunch, have coffee, get your whole day booked to have relationships that you can anchor. And then that's fine. There's nothing wrong with working remotely. It's great. But you got to have relationships and go more.
Certain timetable of how often, and also the webcam.
As much as you can.
And the webcam idea, do you think that helps?
You know, I'm okay with it. I don't know. I don't find it to be all that great. Because you really, it's sort of like watching nonverbals with a cloud. You know, you really can't see the nonverbals as well, and you can't see their eyes. I mean, so you're really not getting the stuff you want to read. So, I mean, I don't know if any of you have done web conferences, but it's really frustrating. There's a level to it that just sort of frustrates you, and that's what it is. You can't read people.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for the very entertaining and informative time you shared with us. My question is that from being a young person who's observing for all those years, did you find that emotion was a universal response? So through the body language, even if you're in a different culture, it's the same pain, look for pain or for...
Yeah, people block it differently, though. You know, people have different ways of dealing with it. I was in Honduras for a week this summer in a pretty tough, poor part of the island of Roatan. And then I was in Africa for 3 weeks. And we're way out in the eastern side of Kenya where my son started this group. We did a water system there, my son's group. And we got to go places where they've never seen white people face to face. And they don't speak English. Most don't speak English. And the ability to communicate with them was amazing. So you know, we saw their emotions. You know, we literally, the system my son and his buddies did provided one spigot of water for 3,000 people. And they were ecstatic. They were dancing. Their dancing is their great moments. They had a six-hour ceremony. You could see all the emotions. And what we did is luckily, we took a lot of video and a lot of photos, close-ups of people's faces, which is pretty amazing. If you want to read something on faces, what's the show out now? Lie to Me? Lie to Me? That's all based in a book by a guy named Paul Erdman. And Paul Erdman has this whole deal on faces and everything about how people's muscles work in their faces, and he's got it down to a science. His professor that motivated him didn't get it down to a science. He could just look and say, that person's from a really hostile, angry culture, and then this one's from a very friendly culture. Paul's documented for the rest of us, and it's really interesting because it crosses all cultures.
Would you conclude then that the emotions were a common denominator?
Yeah. I mean, that's what makes us human. My dogs think they're human, but they're not.
John Davies, thanks for joining us. Technology Management Program.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.